So welcome to the Mission Makers podcast live from Amsterdam Dance Event. Really excited to be diving into a very important topic of negotiations today, uncovering the mysterious and hidden conversations that take place behind the scenes between managers and agents. Joining me today is Letitia Van Riel and John Sachs. Letitia is the owner of LVR Management, and she manages artists such as Anna and Weber, and she also works alongside Ben Turner at Graphite Management, where they oversee the management of Richie Horton and Sama Abdulhadi. And I'm really lucky to say that I'm also her mentee. And we're also joined by her colleague, John Sachs, who represents an impressive roster of renowned artists from Anna to Guy J, Victor Ruiz. So welcome, guys. My name's Farah Nanji. I'm an artist, podcaster, and producer. And over the next hour, we're going to be exploring the various factors that influence artist fees, how agents and managers work together to secure the most in-demand gigs, managing careers with finesse while maintaining the integrity of the artist's vision. So let's dive in. So Letitia and John, what symbiotic harmonies aligned to unite you both in representing the artist that you share? And can you give our audience a glimpse into what a typical day looks like between you both?
Yeah, so we started working in 2016, I believe, on Anna together. And on any given day, I normally wake up to several WhatsApp messages from Letitia, I'd say, because there is a 9-hour time difference with her, actually 8 hours from Lisbon to San Francisco. But yeah, normally, you know, there's a lot of weekends to take care of. I represent Anna and Victor for North and South America, which means anywhere from 15 to 20 weeks out of the year between the both of them. I'm building their tour calendars. So on any given day, I'd say we talk pretty much every day. Yeah. Wouldn't you say so?
Yes. Yeah. We started working together, like you said, 2016 on Anna. And then this year we started working on Victor Ruiz. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we just always, it's funny because when John and I actually reached out to John before, when I first started working with Anna, about her. And at the time she was just, you know, fresh up and coming, and it wasn't the time to start working together. So it's just to say that sometimes you can have a manager and it's just the beginning of the career, but you know, it didn't like suit at that time. But then we started working together, and it's been a long time now. Mm-hmm. And it's been great. Yeah. Working. Yeah. And I wake up 8 hours before. So John wakes up to a bunch of messages, sometimes goes to sleep, gets messages, and then wakes up the next day with more messages. But yeah, we're just always working on, because Anna is going a lot to North America, and Victor now more and more since working with John. So that's been really good for his career. And yeah, just making sure that the tour is, like, now we're already, you know, programming Anna's tour for May. So as you can see, it's really far ahead where we're planning. Mm. Yeah.
And what does a typical trip to Amsterdam Dance Event look like for a manager and an agent?
Well, Amsterdam Dance Event is the center of the electronic music universe. 400,000 people coming from all over the world. You know, there's nothing like the energy of ADE. You know, everybody being in the same room together, agents, managers, publicists, artists. You know, it's that same kind of camaraderie and energy that brings us all to the dance floor together as well.
I call it like a school reunion. Yeah. Like everyone's coming together, and we even like just saying hi to, you know, certain promoters, or just there isn't like, sometimes you're just having a meeting, but just to catch up, right? And just to put a face to the name. So it's really nice.
Yeah, there's some meetings that I get nervous about. And then by the end of it, I'm like, why was I so nervous? We just, you know, just being in the same room and connecting and having a casual conversation is one of the most important aspects of ADE. And, you know, there's other times where there's a lot of time sensitive information that needs to get sorted out. And ADE used to be, you know, cyclically being in mid-October, used to be kind of mapping out the beginning of the following year. And now I've noticed, you know, we're already, as Letitia said, into the middle and even Q3 of 2024 now. So
So yesterday, John and I met and we spoke about Anna and Victor Ruiz, and we were talking already about next year and just going through festival targets and the clubs that we want to be hitting up, and yeah, just aligning, making sure that we're both on the same page about what we I want and what my artists want for, yeah, the year ahead. Because, you know, the bookings do happen so far ahead that it's important for John to, you know, already be pushing and getting. Although, of course, he knows this, you know, it's important that we're aligned on it.
Yeah, and it's exciting when you look further and further into the calendar as an artist gets bigger.
Of course. You know,
because there's so much more demand. And we've noticed that with Anna over the last 7 years. We're just booking further and further out. So it's exciting.
Out of, like, how much percentage of the requests do you actually take, like, from all the...
That's a great question. I think that it's got to be less than 5%. I mean, really? Maybe even less than that.
Wow.
By the time you're at a position like Leticia and I with our artists, you know, there's so many relationships to cultivate. And there's not too many times that new clubs and festivals come up where we don't already have a relationship. So... I actually have a templated reply to cold calls. and, you know, I'd say at least half a dozen or so every single week, Leticia's forwarding me inquiries for Victor and Anna.
Yeah.
Many of them materialize.
Exactly. Sometimes you reply to promoters like, yeah, John Sykes will take over. And then I'll send him a message like, I'm just being polite.
Yeah.
Just being honest.
Funny. So how do you both believe the industry landscape has sort of changed over the years? I mean, what were you hoping to see, you know, change after COVID-19? And do you think that any of these changes have actually manifested?
I would say, I think everybody, the thing about COVID is that it affected everyone in entertainment and the event industry equally to a certain degree. You know, there are some economic moments that happen, you know, over the last 15 years where it affected some people differently than others. But with COVID, I mean, there wasn't one or two events. There were zero events, for a year or 2 years, you know. So
I think, like, from my point of view, I think the whole industry hoped that things would come down a little bit in terms of, like, how insane it is to work in this industry, right? Like how... Yeah, it's quite energetic, but it didn't. It actually, as soon as we came back, it was even, like, last year was insane. I think we went from 0 to 100, like, just in a question of weeks. It was insane. So this year, I've noticed it's come down.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's been tough on a lot of, like, medium-sized artists, a lot of people that were gaining momentum before COVID. Kind of unfortunately lost, and it's been a struggle to come back. I think promoters prefer to play it safe, and they are booking, right? Like the more like people that they know sells tickets. So I think it's become a little bit more difficult for the middle, you know? So But it's going well. It's going well.
Now let's talk about pricing. How do you actually price an artist market value? What are the most important factors that sort of make up that price point?
I would say ticket sales from the previous event in the market is probably the most important. Now, if you're part of a multi-artist lineup, it's kind of hard to measure that. But I would say that's probably one of the most important indicators. But the difficult thing about that as an agent is that you have to think about hype. And hype is intangible and hard to measure. And a lot of the time with artists who ascend quickly, or say there's a new album that comes out, or there's some circle, you know, video that goes viral or something like that, you want to make sure that you're not undervaluing as an agent. But also it's just as important to not overvalue as an agent as well, because it's bad when you approach certain promoters and, okay, I'm not going to confirm an artist for less than this fee. And then they do that fee and they lose money, and it hurts the relationship, not just between the agent and the promoter, but with the artist and the promoter as well. And that's actually taken artists a step backwards instead of forwards.
Mm. Yeah, sometimes, like, when I get sent a really high offer, you know, for, I'm like, wait, this might be too much, because, you know, the artist maybe hasn't played that. And if the, like John said, if the promoter loses money, the artist might not get booked again, especially if it's a good promoter. So we have to be very careful with this. And I think sometimes artists, managers, and everyone can get greedy and ask for a lot of money. And actually, this for the long term is not good. So you have to, you know, go slowly. This industry takes time and everything. So, yeah, I think greed can be a little bit damaging for an artist's career. You can make a lot of money very quickly, but then you don't last very long. Mm. So yeah, these relationships between artists, agents, managers, and the promoter, it's super important. And I think sometimes promoters and agents and managers, they feel a little bit like they're playing against each other, which shouldn't be the case. We're very much together, you know. Mm. So yeah.
And how much percentage would you say social media followers and all that sort of, you know, all that jazz that we don't like to, you know, think about, but it is the sad reality, unfortunately, plays into it. I mean, do you think it's 50% of the value, or what benchmark could you give?
I think now, like, you know, promoters are getting really clued on that people are buying followers. Yeah. So they're really looking at the engagement on social media more than the amount of followers. Because if you are amateur promoter, then you look at that and you get impressed by that and you might book that. But, you know, the established promoters, they know. So the engagement is very important. But it does play a part. You can't deny it. Mm-hmm. It's an important thing. Social media, you can kind of see, like, if you have more followers, then it means you probably sell more tickets, you know? So it does play a part, yes.
But sometimes there's been many case studies about, you know, TikTok songs that have gone viral and it's amounted to nothing. Yeah. Or they got millions of Spotify followers, but they can't sell ticket sales.
Yeah.
Obviously there's a lot of factors that go into, you know, selling out that event. How do you guys actually leverage each other's strengths as managers and agents? How do you divide responsibilities? And how does that synergy then enhance the overall deal-making process?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, this is a unique scenario where Leticia and Anna and Victor are all from South America, which is part of my jurisdiction.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, artists and managers who are based in Western Europe are from Europe. And so with Leticia, you know, she has certain relationships in Brazil, for example, that I might not have. So we do leverage that. You know, for Anna and Victor. And then, you know, in other places, sometimes we'll take meetings together, like with Insomniac, for example, because we both have that relationship. So I think that, you know, if you have the right, if you have the right relationship between an agent and a manager, then you do leverage that. And every decision, whether it be touring or music, it can be done with surgical precision as long as we're communicating consistently. So
I think we need to explain a little bit, because I think sometimes people don't know the difference between a manager and an agent. I know, you know, we know, but maybe it's good for me to explain, you know, like, so an agent is like the salesperson, you know, they have the product, the artist, and they're just pitching it to, you know, promoters to try and get the gigs. And the manager like oversees the career of the artist, everything, you know, where they're going to release, where they're going to play. And, you know, we take an overall view of everything. So John represents my artists in North and South America. And it's crazy that, you know, North America is such a big territory that all artists only have one agent for North America. You know, so you can have a European agent, but it's North America is its own
different
thing. Yeah, it's a whole different thing. So yeah, like we both have relationships. So, you know, not only with John, but with the agent in Europe, I have relationships with, you know, like Tomorrowland, I can speak directly and the agent will then speak and we'll make it, you know, happen. But always goes through the agent. I will never close a deal directly. I'll always pass it over to John or to the other agent to, you know, deal with the final details.
And so going into those final details, what are the sort of various areas that are very crucial in these negotiations, and how do you ensure that your artists are actually protected in these agreements?
Well, billing, set times, those are two vital parameters for festivals. And it's a good thing Anna begins with A, because she's normally at the top of those alphabetically billed festivals. And Victor's at the bottom. So I would say billing and set times is even more important than the fee in a lot of cases, depending on the festival.
And sometimes if the fee is not where we would hope, then we're really pushing for the billing to be high, you know, or the set time or something for them to.
Exactly,
That comes, you can negotiate that as well. So it's super important. Mm. But I must admit that I say, like, you know, even when you close a contract and even when you sign a contract, for me, the biggest contract is the money being in the bank account. Because, you know, there is in this industry, sometimes there's a lot of, you know, we're talking about artists which are like, you know, headliners, but with smaller artists that I also represent, you know, the money being in the bank account is the biggest contract of them all, because some promoters are a bit dodgy.
Leticia might not see it every booking, but every booking, myself or my booking coordinator will dial in the first 50% deposit date, the second 50% deposit date. And yeah, Monday mornings, Tuesday mornings, early in the week, we're chasing payments all the time. And we actually, there's somebody at Liaison who's like one of her most important job tasks is to chase payments in addition mm-hmm. to sending contracts out. So that is a really important parameter as well. And then, you know, there's some artists who have really strict ground transportation needs from the airport to the club, to the sound check. You know, there's other artists who are live performers and who check a bunch of bags and need a certain car type to pick them up from the airport. So those are all really important parameters that I dial in before the ink hits the paper.
Mm. I think one thing, the question that you asked before about COVID, something that has changed, is also the fact that ticket sales have, you know, are now like right the week of the event. Like, where I think a lot of people got scared that they had bought a lot of tickets, never got refunded. So now it's right at the end. So a lot of, for promoters to make the payment, that has been a bit complicated as well too. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, at what stage would you sort of pull back? Is it like, would you actually wait until the day before, or would you sort of like the week before or even a month before, if it hasn't come in, would you pull the plug?
This is when John and I, like, if we know the promoter and we, you know, have a long-standing relationship, we can trust, you know. But if, like, for an up-and-coming artist, like, it's, we start pulling, like, the agent has to tell us far in advance, and then we start monitoring the situation, and then we'll make a decision. Like, I will not let my artist travel without money. Mm-hmm. A lot of promoters are like, don't worry, we'll pay you on arrival. And I'm just like, no, I've done this before, I've learned from it, and I highly recommend that nobody travels without the money on their bank account.
Definitely. It's really interesting because both of you, you know, work with each other, but you also have co-managers and you have different agents, as you touched upon, in different territories. So can you shed light on how you create this sort of optimal team flow when the team starts getting bigger and bigger? And how do you approach differing opinions, maybe on career decisions and pricing strategies amongst the team?
Well, to answer that first part, we share Google calendars, which is really vital. It's live. You know, I can update it from my phone if I'm on the move. There's a lot of different database systems. Like, I know a lot of Europeans prefer like ABOS and System One. We use Gigwell at Liaison. That's just like where we add our calendars and contract our shows and collect our deposits and stuff. But the way that I communicate to European agents is normally through that Google calendar, that shared calendar. There's other moments where I'll just reach out and I'll be like, hey, I know that Extrema Festival is always in late May, but we just got this offer for Movement in Detroit, you know, same weekend. So that's how we communicate with regard to the calendar. To answer the second part of the question about, you know, the certain strategies, there are moments where we do have disagreements between managers and agents and just about strategy and whether or not a show is worth doing. And, you know, fortunately, I think that the best way to combat those differences is just to kind of take a look at, you know, what did this event do for previous artists? Did it help their profile? Was it worthwhile?
Yeah. So I rely on John to know the territory, to tell me why. You know, I'm not from the US. You know, but I have experience, but he knows. So if he tells me, trust me, this is a good idea. You know, working with John for so long, I trust his opinion, you know. The thing about the Google Calendar is super important that John puts the information in there as soon as possible because, you know, I have a lot of options coming from Europe and then I can see, oh, I don't know, maybe he has Movement option in there. So I have to, you know, make sure that, yeah. And sometimes it's annoying because you have amazing things on the same weekend and you have to make decisions, but yeah.
What about if one of your artists, you know, gets to play at a sick after party, right? Which happens a lot in our industry. Do those parties, you know, do they have a financial value attached to them? Are they agreed beforehand? You know, are you negotiating that backstage in the green room just before you go to the villa?
Like, it's funny you should mention because one of my artists loves an after party. Yeah. So sometimes we get offered an after party and we're like, no, probably should go to sleep because you have an early flight. But then we're like, she's going to go anyway. So we might as well take it, you know, because at least we get paid for it because she's going to go and play anyway. So, this gets, you know, the after parties, they get offered on the spot. I'm not there. John is not there. Yeah. You know, it's up to the artist. Some I don't even know until I hear like weeks later that happened. But a lot of times we get offered before as well. So then we negotiate. Yeah.
Most of the time it's before. There have been some moments where there have been unmarked after parties that the promoter who booked the original show wasn't involved in. Yeah. And sometimes that promoter can get mad that they go and play again because it, you know, devalues. And hey, how come they didn't have to pay, but I had to pay, you know? So yeah, it's...
Yeah, you have to be careful when you do that. Yeah, but they keep it on the down low.
Yeah.
When an independent artist negotiates, you know, bookings without an agent, what are some of the most important things that you think they should be aware of and should know? Apart from obviously trying to get the money in the bank first, which is much harder, I think, when you're up and coming.
So, I mean, I was just going to say, first and foremost is making sure you're getting paid. You don't have much leverage in that position. But you also don't have much leverage when it comes to what, you know, your set time throughout the evening. And I would say it's really important to have your technical writer and your hospitality writer dialed in. You know, if you need... You know, I kind of run hot and when you're at the club and you're sweating all the time, you know, it's really important that artists have their, you know, towels ready to go, fans ready to go. It's, depending on the time of year and where you are, it can get super humid and, you know, sweat coming, dripping down the walls. It's so, it happens. And like a lot of the time, I would say you really need to make sure that your technical writer, even more importantly than your hospitality writer, is dialed in. You know, some DJs only play on Pioneer mixers, not Zone or Allen and Heath. Yeah. And so when you walk in there and there's a different mixer type than you're used to, that's an extremely uncomfortable situation. I've seen it happen with artists in the past and have it be a surprise. You know, you want to be as comfortable as possible as you begin your set. And so technical writer, hospitality writer, I'd say those are probably some important parameters.
Was the question for up-and-coming artists?
Up-and-coming artists don't have an agent yet.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're an up-and-coming artist, like being very demanding can be, you know, it's complicated. So it's like the hospitality writer kind of like you just ask for some drink tokens more than, you know, more than a bottle of tequila and champagne. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful with that. And yeah, the technical writer, a lot of people just turn up, they're like, oh, anything will do. And it's like, no, actually, you should have an opinion, like where you feel most comfortable. So yeah, just make sure you have that.
Definitely. Now, it's often harder to price a shift upwards than it is downwards, right? So how do you, you know, artfully negotiate a rise in fees as your artists start getting bigger and bigger, especially with, you know, these promoters that you've had a long-standing relationship with for such a long time?
That's such a great question because I wish I had a crystal ball that just said, okay, how many tickets will this artist do in this market? And there can be an incredible amount of hype behind an artist, and that might be reflected in their draw in New York and Miami and LA, but that might not be reflected in their draw in significantly smaller markets. So I can you know, speak until the cows come home about how big an artist is, but if people in a very small market don't respond well, or if they don't keep their ear to the ground like ticket buyers do in the major markets, then that hype doesn't translate into ticket sales, and in which case I'm wrong in that scenario. So it's very important to, as we discussed earlier, make sure that we're not overcharging. But forecasting a shift upwards is definitely more difficult. I would also say that in the context of the agent manager relationship, it's also humbling and difficult sometimes to price downwards. And that's important sometimes. Yeah. You know, fortunately, Leticia and I haven't had to deal with that yet or recently, but you know, it's important because in order to keep artists on the road, and you're going to need to have some difficult conversations if the ticket price is not lined up with what the performance fee should be or what an artist or manager wants it to be.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, you have an artist playing a territory and then, you know, another promoter announces a party in the same weekend at the exact same, and then like, you know, you have so much competition, so your artist doesn't sell as many tickets as they could have. And this affects like, oh, it didn't do as well. And you're like, that's so not fair. Like there was, you know, someone huge playing next door. So it's tough. But, you know, if you're, that's what we were talking about before, you have to be realistic and be honest. Like, okay, well, let's just do for the same fee. Because usually you always kind of increase the fee every time you go back to, you know, to the promoter, to the territory, you will increase it slightly, you know. But sometimes you just don't. You're like, hey, we didn't do as well, so let's just keep it the same. Going down is a difficult conversation to be had with the artist sometimes, you know, from a management perspective. But yeah, we usually try to keep it the same. Yeah.
And do you think things like boiler rooms and circles, do they sort of, you know, catalyze that to become a bit higher, the price? Or does it now, you know, most artists, big artists have done those performances. So
It helps with the buzz, right? Yeah, and the artist. So that will help, but not like in a tangible, you can't, but there is hype, so people want to book them. And you know when an artist is in demand and when you can ask, because you're getting incoming emails, you know, as an agent, because I used to be an agent, I know, I mean, that, you know, if you're really trying to push someone, it's difficult for you to ask for a lot of, when there is incoming, then you know your artist is in demand. And usually a boiler room will help that. So yes, the fee goes up with that, you know. Yeah.
And what about production value? I mean, if the artist starts having a major number one, not only just on Beatport, but, you know, even in the more commercial markets, like we've seen like Peggy Goo, for example, has really transcended a lot of that, you know, I mean, does that sort of, massively explode their fee in a way? And can the promoters even afford that as they start going into those bigger territories, you know?
Yes, it definitely impacts their fees.
Yeah, I would say there's so many incredible, groundbreaking sets that are online, especially with circles. And in Anna's case, she did a circle in a museum in France, I think. Yeah. I've probably sent 300 promoters that link. And then Victor's Beirut live set last year, same thing. Yeah. And what it does is it communicates stage presence and track selection and methodology, DJing and live performing. And it's a really good indication of what you're going to get when I sell you an artist.
Mm. I mean, with, you know, my artist Sama Abdulhadi, her boiler room was like a big pivotal moment for her career. Really people paid attention. So having one of those opportunities will definitely turn the dial for you. Will definitely put you in another level.
So let's talk about different markets. You know, obviously the music industry is a global industry, and it's amazing that you can go to every corner on earth almost and there'll be a scene sort of bubbling and emerging somewhere. So how do you approach negotiations in emerging markets where they may not have that budget, you know, or even maybe the logistical infrastructure? And how do sort of cultural differences and local music scenes influence the pricing and the demand for your artists?
I love this question because in places like Colombia and Argentina right now, both countries are dealing with devaluation of their currencies. Yeah. And it's a very extreme fluctuation, even within the last couple of weeks and months. And these are two electronic music powerhouses. And it's really sad when, you know, I book a fee and then I book a show at a certain fee and then 3 months go by and the currency becomes extremely devalued. I guess it's important to note that we always contract every single show in USD. Doesn't matter whether it's one of the 14 or 15 other countries other than the US that I work in. Every show's in USD. Culturally speaking, though, it's crazy how certain genres kind of come and go. Like, and, you know, the harder, faster techno sound right now is very popular in the Americas. And, you know, it'll be really interesting to see how long that staying power is. With regard to traditional house and techno, I think that there's a lot of markets, of course, Detroit with techno and Chicago with house being the birthplaces of both those genres. That's not going to go anywhere anytime soon. But there are some tides with a lot of different genres where the hype comes in and out. And by the time the show actually plays out, that hype may have changed. I think as an agent, I kind of have to put on like a political scientist hat too sometimes. I know that there's some elections in South America in the weeks ahead where we've had to move shows around, and those election dates can change, which means, you know, I've had to kind of have to reroute shows, and it's been a bit of a moving target. But these are all really important things that an agent needs to keep their eye on, 365 days a year.
Yeah, when we're trying to plan tours, we're always like, oh no, but it's Chinese New Year, it's Ramadan. It's, so you have like all these different, and also territories, you know, like South America is complicated sometimes. India is a complicated market as well. But with experience, you know how to handle and who to work with and things like this. But yeah.
What makes it complicated?
Well, you just have a lot of people who then decide to become promoters and they are not serious, you know, but then they that's what makes it complicated. They're like, they promise you and then they cancel a gig, they move the gig to another venue, they don't tell you, then last minute, you know, they're like, the money hasn't arrived. You're like telling you, no, don't worry, you get here, you get the money. And of course, when I'm, you know, we're talking about Anna and, you know, so you have, you say no and it's no, you know, and you're dealing, but when you're dealing with smaller artists, you have to kind of, you know, sometimes work with smaller promoters, and that's where the danger is. And that's where it gets complicated because you're like, I can't keep saying no to all of these, you know, up and coming promoters because they deserve a chance as well. You know, we all need to like get up, you know, to grow, for the industry to grow and give opportunities. But then sometimes it can, yeah, that's where it gets complicated. Mm. And, you know, if the money is not in, that's the biggest complication of them all because, yeah.
And what about, you know, when you sort of have like, let's say a market like India where, you know, probably different promoters can kind of share some of that cost. Is that down to the agent to sort of help, you know, say, well, hey, there's, you know, maybe a promoter in Pune. Why don't you guys collaborate? Or is that more down to the region and the people inside that region to work together to kind of help sort of, you know, share those costs?
Usually you would have like one, let's say one promoter that kind of deals with all the different ones in the different territory, you know, in Delhi or in Pune or, you know, and then they, one person takes care of everything. So I wouldn't be dealing with a bunch of different people in one country. I'll just go to one person.
Okay. Interesting. So with the, you know, increasing importance of mental health and wellness in the industry, and especially after such grueling touring schedules, and I think also a reflection moment where a lot of artists really appreciated the downtime in COVID, how do you factor in those sort of very necessary downtime periods? And how does this affect the price of tours and performances?
You know, it's funny because we offers are coming in all the time. And it's so easy to just keep saying yes. And I, you know, I've learned that it's super important for mental health, for the artists to also for them to enjoy being on the road, because if they start like being stressed and not in a good mood and everything, then everyone gets stressed. Then the shows are not as good. So sometimes we, you know, we put like off in the calendar and I tell the agents, don't even tell me that there is an offer for, I don't know, you know, for this amazing, I don't even want to know. Because if you go to the artist, you're like, yeah, but maybe you can play main stage, you know, so it's better we don't even know. Before I used to be like, oh, you can tell me, but now it's kind of like, don't even tell me. Yeah. I don't even want to know.
Yeah. The thing about ADE this time of year, you know, we're approaching the end of the year, and it just gets so grueling by it. It's very cyclical, you know, and to have that break between the holidays and the start of the new year, for me at least, I just feel so refreshed and rejuvenated in January. As an artist, there's an interest in kind of creating a bit of scarcity on your calendar by taking time off, and January tends to be a very popular time to do that. Kind of going back to the previous question about holidays and stuff, you know, there's MLK Day and there's President's Day in January and February, respectively. And I tend to have a lot of Europeans come here because it's dead in Europe in that time frame in a lot of places. But some people take January off completely. Others, you know, let's tour hard because there's going to be a little bit less competition at that time of year. So, but yeah, with regard to mental health, it's such a crucial part of the entire the entire picture, and that's true not just for artists but for agents, managers, everyone. And I think just the more time that you take off in that time of year, a lot of the time it can translate into having more opportunities to do better shows once you're back and once you're refreshed.
But and saying no really, really creates more demand. And I think a lot of artists get scared of saying no. But trust me, it really from experience, you say no, they'll come back and they'll offer more. You say no, they'll come back. It really happens. I know it's scary, but it's a good strategy.
Nice. Yeah. I want to ask you a juicy question. Can you share a challenging negotiation scenario that you faced and how did you resolve it successfully?
I have one. you know, we all work in the industry. We all have, you know, difficult situations sometimes with each other and everything. And there was one of my artists was playing in the same lineup as Yeah, I cannot get too much into it. But so this other agent was really pushing for his artist to be above my artist, but my artist really made sense for it to be higher. But he was friends with the promoter. And so, yeah, I got on the phone. I got very serious. And in the end, we, you know, we got our spot. But it can be very... you cannot be scared. You really have to go for it. You know, you're looking after your artist's best interest. And yeah, this is why it's good to have a manager, because the manager is the bad cop, you know, so you can, you know, so the artist doesn't even have to know that you're doing this. And you're like going full guns blazing in there and like, no, let's do things right. I'm someone that I believe in being very fair. You know, I've been in this situation as an agent where both of my artists are competing. That's where it gets really awkward.
Oh, yeah,
so,
for sure.
So over to you, John.
Yeah, I think Leticia and I have played good cop, bad cop before. Yeah. You know, I've been the bad cop as well. Yeah. I would say really one important thing that you have to do, I would think that there should be a rule. I always say this. There should be a rule that if you're an agent, you ought to be a promoter first, because you really need to see what it's like on the other side of the coin. See what it's like to book a show, have it not sell well, and lose a bunch of money. Yeah. It's so important to know what that feels like as an agent. And a lot of agents don't know what that feels like. Yeah. So to answer your question about difficult situation, if you really, as an agent, put on your promoter hat and think, what does this person need in order to have a successful event? That's not just good for the event itself, but also you can leverage your artist. Okay. You know, to answer your question, like there was a moment where we had a bit of it was like a small, like 2,500 person festival in South America. And it was like a 3 or 4 artist lineup. And if my artist wasn't on that bill, they would have canceled the show, because we just wouldn't have done the tickets. And I knew that. Yeah. And so it's a very difficult situation. That's why, you know, your phone is your friend in that regard. Get on the phone, say the things that you wouldn't want to be forwarded in an email, you know, I'll leave it at that. But you know, there's times when you really need to lay down the law, you know. Yeah. And if you need to know what that leverage feels like as an agent, but you also need to know what that promoter needs. You need to put yourself in their shoes as well.
And when an offer comes in, do you accept it, or do you always try to push for a little bit more? And what's the time sensitivity around, you know, when an offer comes in? Like in a week, is it the deal's sort of not hot anymore? And it's like, you know,
it depends the size of the artist again. Mm-hmm. You know, if they really want the artist, they'll be there for months waiting for a reply. We are very quick, usually. I haven't been very quick in the last month, sorry.
Yeah, sure,
John
Leticia.
Is like, I'm waiting.
Yeah, we're quick. No. I think it is event dependent and artist dependent. For huge festivals, we tend to have a little bit more time. Also, some promoters are very strict about their offer expirations. Others aren't. Again, that's also artist dependent.
And you should explain about the hold situation. North America is a bit different than the rest of the world. So yeah, I don't know, maybe so, you should just...
The hold situation. So yeah, in the US especially, we have this hold system where I kind of imagine everybody lining up in a single file line. And you know, the bigger artists tend to be at the front of that line, first hold and the second hold. You know, and this is a good setup for promoters too, because you know, the promoters have to fill every Friday and Saturday at their venue. And what the hold system does is kind of like it's a pecking order of the artist that the promoter wants to book. And it's a little bit different in Europe, and Leticia can speak on that. But in the US, if you're a second hold or a third hold and the date is approaching and you have the fee and the agent and manager and artist all agree that that's the fee that they want, then you can challenge the first hold. And the challenge is, you know, you gotta like, I don't know if I can swear here, but you have to shit or get off the pot, essentially, if you're the first hold. So that's what happens when you challenge. And then at that point, it's you. The promoter normally gives the first hold 24 to 48 hours to confirm or decline. Mm-hmm. So.
But yes, there is, you know, there is an expiry date for, And then sometimes artists take a long time and, you know, we do try and negotiate, but sometimes it's not about the fee, but it's about the billing. It's about, you know, the set time. No, we would love to do it, but we need to try and swap with this artist, and then it goes back to John.
Yeah, so sometimes it's good to not, sometimes it's good to take more time. Sometimes that's strategic, but other times, you know, because if we have a show that's 8 months in advance and, you know, Anna's based in Lisbon. Victor's based in Lisbon. I'm not going to confirm one show by itself. I need to route dates around it. And so sometimes it's strategic. Other times it's just logistics.
A golden question that I'm sure many people in the room have, and I know in your mentorship program, we touched on this, is what's the ideal moment that an artist should seek out a manager and agent? And is there a sequence in which one should come first?
If you feel that you're doing, if you feel that there is a little buzz, you're doing the right things, you know, people are asking you for your tracks, bigger artists are playing your music, you're playing enough gigs, not only in your city, but like around in your country and everything, then I think this is the thing, there isn't a rule that one thing should come first, because sometimes you have a lot of artists who don't have managers, even now, you know, they have agents. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there is the first thing. I think if you have someone that approaches you, that has contacts in the industry, that is willing to work their asses off for you, and they believe in you, because that's so important, like to really believe in what you're selling as a manager and as an agent, then, you know, like take it and try it. Just don't sign a contract, you know, but give it a shot for like, and see how it goes. But I don't think there is the first, you know, I started being Anna's agent before I became her manager. But I don't think there is a rule.
I would say if you're European and you have a lot of inquiries in the United States, then that would be, that's probably the one scenario where you can't just walk into the US and play. It's a very convoluted process to get a non-immigrant work visa in the US.
Yeah. Very expensive.
Very expensive. And the application is crazy. Yeah. And so in that scenario, you know, when Leticia approached me about Anna in 2016, we had to make sure, does she have 30 English speaking press articles and all the other items on that checklist, which is a super long list. At that point, once you're getting enough inquiries where you can build cohesive tours, that's when you should get an agent.
Mm. Yeah. North America, you know, is different, because if you're in Europe, but yeah, to go to North America, there is all of this. But if you're in Europe, like, you know, whatever comes first, you know, give it a shot. Mm. There isn't a rule, basically.
How does someone who doesn't know you guys or agents and managers at your caliber approach you and pitch themselves to you? What are the things that you pay attention to? You know, or is it always, you know, really a relationship based thing where, you know, someone's recommended or you've built up that relationship? Do you consider cold approaches?
You know, because of my mentoring program, I'm getting a lot of, you know, like up and coming artists that reach out to me. And, you know, sometimes they just write one sentence like, hey, you want to be my manager? Great. No.
Yeah. Those are the funniest. You know, ones. So, like, it's like, I want an agent. There's an email. It's like, exactly. I want an agent and that's it.
Yeah. Like, it's wow. Getting, me too. I'm like, oh God, right, so much to learn. Can't do my mentoring. Yeah, yeah. But no, if you send me an email just telling me who is playing your tracks or where you're playing and, you know, your social media links and, you know, then I'll have a look at it, but it doesn't immediately mean, you know, that that will happen. One thing I always check when I go on Instagram, I know this is just a little tip, but I see who else from the industry is following that artist. Mm. And if I see, you know, oh, John, why is John following this person? You know, then it kind of makes me curious. Yeah. And I might reach out to John and ask him, oh, how did he find out? And, you know, things like this, like, kind of catch your attention a little bit.
Promoters use that tactic as well. It's like, how many people in my market follow this person? That's a really important parameter that a lot of promoters use. For me, it's rare when somebody who's viable approaches me, and it's rare when there's no one else in the industry who's heard of them. And if that is the case, normally they're coming from somewhere near me. A lot of the time, a lot of up and coming talent comes through Europe, and, you know, Leticia and other managers in Europe will be aware of them and endorse them. And like Leticia said, that's a really good metric to see who else in the industry follows, and you know, are they playing their tracks? There's a lot of music as well, like when we watch these live streams from Exit Festival or other big festivals, where I'm like, man, this track's amazing, and I'll be the first person to admit I use Shazam a lot in those scenarios. And you know, there have been moments where I've been like, wow, there's like four or five songs that I've seen from the same name, that, you know, 5 or 6 different DJs have played. And that's rare that happens. And they haven't came to America yet, and nobody knows who they are over here, or over there, I should say. But it still happens occasionally.
I think for agents is very different, like the managers, because, you know, like with John, like mainly people will approach you and, you know, like as a manager, I'll come and, hey, do you want to work with this artist? So for managers, it's more like going out and, you know, seeing what's happening, like checking out like boiler rooms or streams or festival lineups, like seeing who, you know, like with ADE, like who is playing here, like what are these names, you know, and kind of having a look at it and then doing some research. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Turning it on the flip side, what are some of the red flags that you think artists should be aware of when they are considering those deals from agents and managers?
You know, it's funny. I don't know if I'm getting old, but for me, I've realized more and more that I like to work with like people who are like quite serious and quite want to, you can tell like they really, that this is really important to them, but like, and that they're gonna like wake up and be there and be proactive and everything. And I think sometimes in this industry, people can get a bit lost in this whole like party scene. And that worries me a little bit, you know, about working with, you know, with this sort of, yeah, because it's long-term. We're both, especially for an up-and-coming artist, you are investing a lot of your time in the beginning of their career where nobody's making money. It's just an investment, you know? So you want someone who will deliver, who will, that's right now, that's something that I noticed in this ADE that it's important to me.
I mean, it is a hedonistic industry and you know, how do you then manage that situation where maybe, you know, things were great and everyone's work ethic was amazing, but then suddenly something changes and they start maybe taking something too much, or, you know, it starts kind of really affecting their work. How do you manage that? What do you do in that scenario?
I haven't had this, you know, I haven't, like, my writers, it's pretty safe.
Yeah.
I've actually had that happen a couple times over the years where, some artists have taken the party side of it a little bit too far. And the thing is, what it comes down to is, there's 7 days in a week. A lot of the time people are going out on Fridays and Saturdays. If an artist needs to blow off some steam, don't do it when you're working on a Friday or Saturday, or at least don't do it to the extent where it affects your performance or your relationships with the promoters. Mm. Obviously that's much easier said than done. Mm. But over the years, there've been moments where people, you know, artists start missing flights, and aren't being responsible. And I would just say, the most important thing you can do from my vantage point is just acknowledge it and say, you know, this is going to affect your relationship with me and with promoters, and just make sure that you're keeping the lines of communication open and just, you know, a lot of warnings. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but there have been times where, you know, the relationships have come to a close because people are just taking it a little bit too far. So, it's nightlife. People go out, but, you know, to blow off some steam the rest of the week, I would say.
Mm, definitely. Okay, final question before we open up for the floor is, where do you see the future of the industry headed, and how do you think the role of managers and agents will evolve alongside these changes?
I'm very excited about the power of data and artificial intelligence. And I think that we can harness the power of data more than we ever could today. And that's only going to get more and more in an optimization kind of direction. As an agent, I'm always optimizing everything, you know, routing and a performance fee and, you know, all the things that we discussed earlier. And I think that the role of an agent and manager won't change with regard to, you know, I don't think that a machine's going to spit out the exact fee that an artist should earn, sort of thing, and because that's always a moving target. But there are a lot of things that we can optimize using programming and machine learning and data already. And so I think that that's really exciting. I would say that's probably the most exciting direction that music's going in right now. So.
I'm hoping, I don't think AI is going to take over my job, but because I do think there is this human thing that, you know, that you work together to, and you need this back and forth. But, you know, I was thinking about this. I think I've started to notice that very big artists are starting to let go of managers, or, you know, when they get to that point where they you know, they will just have assistance or something. And I've noticed that that's, you know, happening. And I wonder if that's, you know, going to eventually become something. But I think in an artist's career, for you to, you know, achieve certain things, the contacts, the things that we bring, and this, and, you know, it's super important. So I don't know, like, you know, I've been working with Anna for 10 years and, you know, I've worked with, you know, my other artists for at least 4 to 5 years. So, and there's never been a thought of, you know, like separating. It's a very, you know, we're in this together. So I think, and I hope, you know, that I would like to see it till we are 90 years old.
Nice. Well, thank you guys so much. And we're very happy to take any questions you guys might have. So don't be shy. Anyone has a question?
No.
No. Okay. Yeah.
So you touched a bit on data, like, right now. And, so I would like to know on the other side, which we're on the promoting side. So right now, how much do you rely on data when trying to evaluate the price for, say, newer markets, which you're not, you know, aware of, don't have like prior relationship with that much? So do you do a lot of data research in terms of like YouTube charts?
Yeah, absolutely.
Should
I talk into this?
Yes, okay. And also let's repeat the question for our guests who are listening into the podcast who are not here in the room.
Yeah, so the question was for markets where I've never booked a show, how do I set the price essentially? And that's a really challenging question. I think that what it comes down to is how close is this market to other places where I have booked, and which artists not on my roster have played these places. Depending on my relationship with those artists' agents, I'll ask those agents, how did the event do? I don't think, it's a little bit confidential how ticket sales and things like that, but if depending on my relationship with the agent, I'll ask what those numbers look like. And then I essentially make a prediction about how my artist would sell. And going back to one of the points that we made earlier, you wanna make sure that you're not overpricing. You want this to be a sustain. If it's a cool new budding market, I want to be doing several events there in the future, not just this one that we're talking about.
There is also something that we always ask for an offer. We never say a price. So sometimes that will be you guys, you know, will give us an indication of where, and then the ticket price, the capacity is, you know, then we can, yeah, kind of think how much you guys can make everyone.
Great. Any other questions? Yes.
Yeah. Whenever you guys were talking about, you guys look for engagement on social media instead of followers. Like, what's a good number of engagements before you would consider an artist?
So the question was, what's a good number of the engagements and social media before signing an artist? Like, what would be a good number? I don't think that there's a set number, but on Instagram, TikTok, SoundCloud. Another interesting point about this question, though, is that the amount of streams that you have on, like, monthly listeners on Spotify, that doesn't necessarily translate into bookings. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time, promoters use that as a metric, but there's a lot of people, especially after the pandemic and people getting older, who they'll still listen to my artists in their headphones at the gym, but they will not buy a ticket. And so that it's hard to gauge based on something like the metric of Spotify monthly listeners. It's hard to give an exact number for followers. Leticia, do you have?
Yeah, on the Spotify for artists, you can really, you know, you can see like where, you know, most listeners are, and it doesn't translate at all. Mm-hmm. Like, not at all, but it's not, you can't use that.
Right. I wish we could. Yeah.
I know.
it would make our lives easier.
Yeah, but it doesn't. It really doesn't. So, and there isn't a number, you know, I think. Sometimes for me, when I go into posts and I see like the hidden likes and everything, that gives me a, you know, like, and there is a lot of followers, that tells me that the person is, you know, not really, there isn't much engagement and everything, that gives it away a little bit.
If they hide their likes.
Yeah, you know, when they're hiding often, but they have like, I don't know, 40,000 followers, but they're hiding all their likes, then you're like, well, that gives it away. It's not helping.
So, good question. Mm-hmm. Probably got time for one or two more. So anyone else?
I would like to know more about
Leticia's
course.
Leticia's course.
Really? Who are you?
Before she describes her course, let me just say the LVR mentorship program is so cool. Farah was a mentee. I'll do some endorsing
but
myself.
Can we do this? I don't know.
Well, we could go for it. I mean, yeah, we can,
sorry,
we can decide whether to, yeah, no, okay. but shout out because it has been a great course. And it's, I think also what you sort of talked about, you know, is that when you're looking for making such a course that, there are a lot of like production courses, but this the actual business side of it isn't so much discussed.
Yeah, I think like during COVID, we did a production masterclass for some of our artists. And then we realized that a lot of, you know, up and coming artists don't have the information about social media, releases, strategy and all of this. And this is why we started this mentorship program that, you know, now we've just filled 40 more students are gonna
out of 300 applications or something crazy.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was insane. It was a lot, and we got 40. But now I also launched my pre-recorded course. That is, you guys can get it and watch it at your own time. And yeah, I teach all of this except there isn't the one-on-one personal, and John Sachs doesn't make an appearance on this one because it's pre-recorded. But on the mentorship, there is. So yeah, and. Yeah, that's great. Nice. Thank you.
Cool. I think it's a good note to wrap it up. Thank you guys so much. This has been the Mission Makers podcast. Thank you again to Letitia and John for joining us today live from the Amsterdam Dance Event Lab.
Thanks a lot, guys.
I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we've enjoyed having these conversations. If you want to grab a copy of today's show notes, then head over to missionmakers.com where you'll also find notes from all of our previous episodes. And if you're interested in talking to me about producing podcasts or coming down to my music and motorsports events, then you can reach out to me at missionmakers or at dj.n1nja on Instagram. The music played in today's episode is an exclusive preview of my upcoming track, Infinite Being, with Deepak Chopra, and it will be coming out early next year. This has been a Mission Makers production. Thank you as ever for listening. And until next time, keep it laser focused.
We're not talking about mind, which is a modified expression of what we call the self. Self is fundamental reality, fundamental being. We call ourselves human beings, not human thinkers, or not human doings, but human beings. So right now, as you're listening to me, if you were just try this, as you're listening to me, be aware of that which is listening.